Hi, I'm Jonathan Chait of the New Republic, and you are David Greenberg of Rutgers University.
That's right.
And for those of you who are watching, the first time I ever spoke with David was when he called me to inform me that I was going to get the internship at the New Republic. He was the managing editor. We worked together. And I think we can agree that was the high point of David's career.
It certainly was. Actually, I talked to you and I interviewed you before that.
No, that's not true. This is the first of several lies. I'm sure you're going to be telling me. I never interviewed for the internship.
Oh, you definitely did.
No, I didn't.
No, I remember having a discussion with you. Margaret Talbot was in the office, and you impressed us with how much of a New Republic junkie you were, because you said something to the effect that you noticed that Weston Kosova hadn't been writing as much lately for the magazine.
Yeah.
Margaret and I exchanged these glances because it was at the time when, in fact, he hadn't been, and you know, there was, and we kind
I
of
didn't realize it was a point of, yeah, no, that actually, that happened after I got the internship. So when you called me and tell me that, then I just kind of came in for a meet and greet before I was going to start. So that was what you're referring to. But yeah.
Well, all right, see, this is how the memory can play tricks.
Already your credibility has been shattered going into this discussion.
Right, exactly. I'm just wildly embellishing the story.
So anyway, having been alerted that no one should trust anything you say about anything, why don't you tell us your problems with my TRB column of a few weeks ago, which was actually sort of taking issue with something you wrote in Slate. This is sort of a good instead of paying for counseling, we can just try to repair our relationship here on Blogging Heads.
Right, exactly. Yeah, I don't know if there is professional counseling for friends, colleagues who get into these fierce disagreements, but
yes.
Well, to be fair, had written this piece first. You, have been perhaps one of the most strident of the voices demanding that Hillary Clinton drop out of the race, but you were by no means the first. And, in fact, there was sort of this drumbeat building as the Texas and Ohio primaries approached. And it just struck me as, gee, it's only March 4th, whatever it is, and I decided to kind of take a look historically at how long previous primary contests, at least on the Democratic side, had lasted. And I noticed that if Clinton had indeed bowed out and Barack Obama had sewn up the nomination March 1st or 2nd or 3rd before those primaries, he would have been the earliest Democratic nominee to sew up the nomination since, say, 1968, when I last looked at it, when the primary system kind of fully emerged as the route by which Democrats mainly chose their candidates. So rather than, as it seemed to be kind of congealing among the pundits, this being an incredibly late date for Hillary Clinton still to be in the race, in fact, as a historical matter, it was quite early, and it's still, I think, quite early. And so part of what I pointed out in that Slate article was there seemed to be a kind of people were caught up in the moment. It's been a hard-fought, very intense, passion-filled primary campaign, and it's kind of natural that people want to see it resolved. But in fact, political time is not always what people take it to be, and there was plenty of time for that to happen. So I'll let you characterize your piece, and then I'll come back and explain to you why I thought it was foolish.
Right. I mean, look, I don't think I wrote this in the piece because I wasn't mainly writing rebuttal of you. I just mentioned you in a few sentences, but the whole political calendar is very different now than it's been through most of recent American history. There was a time, a long time ago, when campaigns were supposed to start after Labor Day, but now they don't anymore. We're in a 24/7 news cycle. Things happen much, much more quickly, and it happens over a much longer period of time. I think candidates have realized that you can shape the electorate, you can define yourself, you can define the opposition months and months in advance. And of course, this was the thing that Bill Clinton used to just destroy Bob Dole in 1996. He just was much more aggressive, much faster in spending and organizing his campaign. So by the time that Dole went to get the nomination, accepted the nomination in San Diego, he was dead in the water. You know, you were the interim editor, I think, of the New Republic, and we did a Dead Man Walking cover. It was already over by that point.
Right. So, although we also did a cover on how Dole could still win, and portraying Vint Lawrence drawing Clinton as the rabbit and Dole as the tortoise, and you know, anyway, I mean,
that wasn't a good idea.
Well, right, but you know, I think I forget who it was. Maybe we got Charlie Cook to kind of pony up and sort of be the kind of dasher of the conventional wisdom, which, you know, as Frank wrote in the New Republic some time ago, Frank Ford, the conventional wisdom is more often right than wrong, but still, it's part of the job of the New Republic to try to confound or question the conventional wisdom.
Right. In any case, I would say that the issue with Clinton staying, it isn't the length per se. If they were tied, of course she should stay in. Or if they were very, very close and she had a strong chance of winning, you know, of course she should stay in. The mere fact of the calendar isn't a good reason to knock her out. The reason is that she has very, very, very little chance of winning the nomination. It's an extremely slender hope. And her continuing to stay in imposes pretty high costs on the Democratic Party's chances of winning.
All right, well, here, can I jump in here on a couple points of criticism?
Yeah.
See, it actually is very, very close. Now, the two matters of how close the race is and how much of a chance she has of winning are actually somewhat different. And I would say if it wasn't close at all, there would be a much stronger case for saying, look, what's she doing staying in? But there would also be a kind of irrelevance to that question. In the past, whenever candidates have kind of really sewn it up, you know, even when they've had competition, the bottom has dropped out of their rival. You know, you saw this with McCain and Huckabee, that Huckabee still had a base of support, but he was, you know, clearly just not coming close to McCain. He was no longer winning primaries, and it sort of just became evident. There was a kind of rallying around McCain, and you've seen this with John Kerry and with other Democrats in the past. I think it's very significant that you haven't seen this coming together around Obama, that you've seen Clinton getting consistently, you know, 40%, 45% staying quite close to Obama in the polls. There have been some where he's pulled away a little bit, but then she's back in the game. You know, the margin in the overall popular vote that they have is still relatively close. It's not a blowout. Now, one can argue, well, does she have a 10% chance, 20% chance, 30% chance? I don't quite know, you know, how
those are all way too high.
Make those scientific calculations. I mean, you know, it seems to me that so long as there is some, you know, possible chance that the superdelegates who will ultimately decide this thing would track her way after every primary and caucus is over and done with, it makes sense. It makes sense for her to give it a shot.
Yeah, I mean, I think basically the closeness of a race is best measured by the chance that one person will win, and you know, if you've got you know, two people running a 100-meter dash, and one of them is you know, 5 meters from the end, and the other is 8 meters from the end. It's close. They're only 3 meters apart. You know, one is only, you know, a few percentage points ahead of the other as a percentage of the total amount they've run. But the fact is, the person who's ahead is going to win, and that's basically what we have here.
Unless you say, well, it's really a half mile that they're running.
Well, Clinton wants it to be, you know, a marathon, but
the length of the meters, you know, I think it is sort of. I just think putting these percentages on it is just a highly subjective matter, and I'm not quite sure how people arrive at these percentages.
You can't do it subjectively, but clearly, you know. You can make a ballpark estimate, right? She doesn't have a 50% chance to win. She doesn't have a 90% chance to win. The numbers are far lower than that. A Clinton strategist told Politico a couple weeks ago that her chances were no better than 10%, and this was when her chances were much better than they are now.
What does that mean? I mean, whether a Clinton strategist said it or Hillary Clinton herself said it or, you know, Howard Dean says it, I'm just not sure why, if those numbers are at all meaningful.
Well, look. Obama has a pledged delegate lead of about 170.
Okay.
No one is any more contending that she has any chance to eliminate that. And I don't think very many people are even suggesting she has much chance to knock it down all that much. A really good scenario would have her maybe knock 40 or 50 delegates. That would, that she would just had totally taken charge of the race from here on out. She could knock 40 or 50 delegates out of his lead. It's going to be more than 100, even under the worst case scenario for him. And I think the most likely scenario by far is that it'll probably stay about where it is. She'll pick up 15 delegates in Pennsylvania. He'll pick up probably more than that in North Carolina, and she'll pick up, he'll pick up some in Oregon, she'll pick up some, we know where, Kentucky and West Virginia.
Right, Indiana.
It's probably going to stay about where it is. That means she's going to need about two-thirds or more of the uncommitted superdelegates to break her way to get the nomination. There are two problems with this scenario. Number one is, over the last month, about 90% of the delegates who've announced have gone his way. So you're talking about, a massive turnaround in the direction of the superdelegates in their decision, which is not that surprising. She basically, all the loyalists, she could get, she had locked up right at the beginning of the race. Number two, there's been a lot of reporting about, what do the superdelegates think, what are they basing their decision on? And most of this reporting, points in one direction, which is that the superdelegates who are undecided now are undecided because they are afraid of stepping on the process. Most of them have come out and said that they basically want to go with the pledged delegate leader, but they don't know who that's going to be for
sure. I'm not
sure
that's true. I mean, there have been a number of prominent Democrats who have said that, but is it really true that most of the uncommitted superdelegates have said that?
They haven't said it publicly because.
They've said it to you.
They said it to my colleague Noam Scheiber, who did a big reported piece in the Superdelegates. He said the overwhelming majority said they want to support the pledged delegate leader. And there have been other pieces in places like the Politico, where basically that's the word that the Superdelegates have given. That's why they're not committed, is because they don't want to step on the process, but they think at the end you wait and see who has the pledged delegate lead, and then you go with that person.
Yeah, except I would argue I think you probably agree with this, if at the end of the primary process, the landscape looks different. And, I would submit that given how many turnabouts and changes in the nature of the political landscape or in our perceptions of that landscape we've seen, in this primary season, it just seems to me we don't know. We don't know, after June 3rd or whatever the date is for the last of these contests, how that landscape is going to look. It may look different. It may look like there's been a narrowing in the pledged delegates, as you say, perhaps not likely, but let's say Clinton cuts into it significantly. Let's say she has some big wins. Let's say she does look like the stronger general election candidate. Well, those pledged delegates who said one thing to Noam back in March when Obama was kind of riding this momentum,
But he's not been riding on momentum. I mean, for the last few weeks, he's had a good few days, but this is all this reporting on the superdelegates has all been done in the period, in the post-Wright period, which is Clinton's best period of the whole campaign.
Well, post-Wright, pre-speech. I think with that speech, he regained the momentum, and, then the Bosnia thing had, I think, longer legs. And so I think, he has regained the momentum recently. Now, maybe the arguments that she should drop out, such as you're making, have actually served to give her a little bit more momentum lately, too. Some people are saying that. Again, momentum is one of these things that I think kind of like this 10% chance, 20% chance of winning. There's clearly something real we're talking about, but much more slippery and elusive than the pundits would have you believe.
Right. No, but I think the overwhelming fact of the primary is that both candidates have very, very resilient bases. I mean, his is just a little bigger than hers, but basically you haven't seen anything that would suggest that he's going to not have the black vote, which, if you go in a Democratic primary, when you have 85 to 90% of the black vote, you don't need very many white people to stay to just stay competitive, which is what he needs to keep the floor from dropping out, to stay competitive. And, you know, young people, high education voters, and people with college degrees, you know, that's a very solid base, and it's been pretty...
Oh, clearly. Oh, he'll stay competitive in her base, to the end, right.
Yeah, in her bases, too. So, you know, they're really fighting between the 45-yard lines for advantage.
I think that's right.
But she can't gain many delegates doing that. That's the whole problem. He can't either. But, he's got a huge lead, and she has no real prospect for changing it.
Given that there's a significant portion of Democrats who seem to feel strongly that she'd be the superior candidate, and given that there's at least a theoretical possibility that the perceptions of superdelegates who have, as you say, been kind of more drifting toward his side than toward hers, certainly, in recent weeks. But given that those perceptions, you know, are quite fickle, it seems to me that if we were having this conversation in June, it could just sound very different. So it just seems to me a lot of this is just very premature.
I mean, it could sound different, but I still don't understand. I'm not saying it's impossible. We're talking about, you know, the possibility that she's going to get to basically change what's been an overwhelming flow of superdelegates to Obama and turn that into an overwhelming flow back in the other direction toward her. In addition to that, what that entails, it's, you know, I think everyone concedes that you're talking about a very, very ugly, drawn-out scenario. In addition to the fact that basically, you know, this is sort of what I speculated it on my TRB, or at least was sort of inferring from the external evidence, and now I think people have been reporting directly that her chance is basically to make the case to the superdelegates is that he's unelectable. But this requires her to take steps to make him unelectable, which is a real problem for the Democratic Party.
All right, and here I guess is where we get into some of the things I wrote about my New Republic piece, which I think they called Double Negative, ran last week. Mm-hmm. And although I don't specifically address your argument about making him unelectable, I would say it's really a matter of revealing him to be unelectable, that the nature of what it takes to win in a Democratic primary is actually quite different
right.
from what it takes to win in a general election.
Absolutely.
I think no one would dispute that.
Right.
And although, you know, we have these anecdotal reports and perhaps some statistical reports of independents and a few Republicans tracking his way, I think his campaign has shifted in its...
that's a pretty established fact in polling. It's not just anecdotal.
Okay, I guess what I meant is anecdotal. The significance of the size of the Republican vote is, I think, impressionistic, and to what degree those same Republicans are actually going to stick with him in the fall, I think, is a question. Anyway,
of course.
But, okay, he has had, no doubt, some of that which argued in favor of his seeming electable. But it seems to me that Howard Dean had this problem in 2003-2004. Because of the kind of left-wing Netroots support that Dean got, Dean, I think, started to make himself more a candidate of the left.
Yeah.
And I see this going on a bit with Obama, too, that I think he has to be careful. I think he's been an excellent campaigner, and I think he probably knows to avoid this. But he runs the risk, and it's not just issues surrounding right and so on. I think it's in a whole host of ways. Being seen as a creature of the movement
right.
can be damaging. Todd Gitlin and I were talking about this, and he described it as it's sort of shaping up as the movement candidate versus the party candidate, which I think is a pretty good way of seeing it. And if Obama's image going into June is that of the movement guy rather than as this kind of independent who has this kind of broad appeal,
right.
then I think superdelegates might well, you know, think, well, that's damaging. So it doesn't involve kneecapping him. It doesn't necessarily involve kind of dredging up, you know, every unfortunate incident from his past, and I'm sort of afraid to even, mention what these negative things about him that could be said are, lest I be accused of kind of, wink, wink, nudge, nudge, trying to kind of reinscribe them. But, lots of things about him have been reported that that fair-minded people might take as engendering doubts about his electability. And especially if you look at electability not as a matter of who's going to just get the most voters, but who's going to win the battleground states that Democrats have needed to win in 2000 and 2004, superdelegates may well decide, especially those superdelegates who haven't yet made up their minds, I think are precisely those who probably have doubts about whether he can deliver. I think, the fact that he's gained a lot of superdelegate endorsements, says that these are folks who have been won over to the fact that he can bring the party to victory in November. Now, more people may well share that judgment, but the fact that they're holding out, suggests maybe these are people who do have doubts, significant doubts along those lines.
Well, you threw in a lot there. Let me address the last point first. Like I said, to the extent that people were reporting what they're thinking, that's not what they're saying. What they're saying is they'd be happy with Clinton or Obama as the nominee, and they want to follow what the pledged delegates say. So I don't think there's any evidence, to the extent that there is a lot of reporting in the superdelegates, I don't think there's a lot of evidence to support your conjecture for what they might be believing. Now, there may be some people like that, but it doesn't seem to be the bulk of their...
Well, I don't think we know. I don't know what goes on in their minds and what they have said to a couple reporters, I think is worth something, but it also, like all of us, their thinking is shaped by the moment, and in such a fast-moving, fast-changing campaign, that thinking changes rapidly.
Let me also move back to your previous point, which I think is a very good one, which is about how the race is pushing Obama to the left and making him less viable in the general election. I think that's true.
Or at least his perception.
That's right. It's making him try to, attack Clinton from the left. Of course, I think it's probably doing the same to her. I think primaries in general do that to candidates. Forces them more towards the extreme. But I think that's another very good reason why the longer the race goes on, the weaker Obama's going to become. And, of course, the same is true of Clinton.
All right, well, I've been talking a lot, but let me just throw one thing out.
Okay.
If his winning is all but inevitable...
Yeah, which it is.
Then he has nothing to fear. Then he doesn't have to tack to the left, precisely because now is the perfect opportunity for him to kind of slough off that perception of being a movement candidate, because he actually can do some of the stuff that Clinton did prematurely in the fall by trying to position herself as a general election candidate.
No, but he still has to. He not only still has to win. He has to win as soon as he can. This is a crucial variable for his success in the fall: is how soon he can drive Clinton out of the race. So he has to run the best primary race he possibly can, so this doesn't go to August, which would be an absolute nightmare. And going to June is bad enough. I mean, that would be pretty damaging. Going to August would just be a death. So he has to campaign as if the nomination is on the line, which it's not. But the time is incredibly important.
Well, I don't think June would be particularly damaging. I think there is a world of difference between June and August or the convention. And now you see a lot of people like Howard Dean tossing out this July 1st date, which of course allows Clinton to stay in the race. Gives her a couple weeks to make the argument to the superdelegates after the primaries are concluded. Look, I'm the winning candidate, and/or I'm the better president, and to close that deal. And obviously, the superdelegates can ignore that July 1st deadline. It's not going to be set in any kind of stone. But if that's something that party leaders are seen to endorse, then her taking it to the convention, I think, will have a very different feel to it than talk like that now has, which I think is strategic and tactical, and is what it is. It's not it should be taken as part of a negotiating process.
Yeah, no, I think that's right. But I think, you know, the fact that McCain's already had an unobstructed free ride for, what, a month now, it's been helpful to him. I mean, McCain has risen in the polls vis-a-vis Obama and Clinton. He was behind, you know, Obama was running well ahead of McCain, and now he's running behind. And that's going to continue until he gets the nomination. In addition, you've got this pretty important opportunity cost where he's you know, had this incredible ability to raise staggering sums of money from a lot of people. You know, if he had locked up the race a month ago, he could have been, you know, doing national advertising, or at least most of the country. He could be defining McCain. He could be defining himself. He could be setting up ground organizations. And, you know, then by the time they got to the general election stage where they were on par financially, he probably would be up by 10 points against McCain, and McCain would be digging out of a hole. Now, the way it's going to be is that Obama's going to be digging out of a hole. And it's always better to, you know, he can dig out of the hole, but it's always better to be ahead than it is to be behind.
I see this as highly, highly speculative, all of what you're saying. I mean, first of all, he has been attacking McCain. I don't think McCain's gotten a free ride. I mean, he, you know, had that gaffe in the Middle East where Lieberman's whispering in his ear. You know, he's getting hit. So
he's rising in the polls, and his positive scores have risen. People now have a more positive impression of him than they did a few weeks ago, and that's extremely rare. Under these circumstances, usually once someone becomes the partisan figure, then things tend to settle along partisan lines.
That's actually not true. I mean, it's the norm is once you sew it up, there is this kind of honeymoon period where you kind of enjoy a bounce. And
unless you've got the other party going, you know, unless the other party's also unified and, you know, is starting to go after you and define you. You know, Kerry had a honeymoon for about a week, and then he started going down rapidly after he sewed up the Democratic nomination.
Right. Well, that also was said something about John Kerry. I mean, yeah. The other thing about John Kerry, which I think we should keep in mind, you know, everybody blames his loss, not everybody, but you often hear his loss attributed to the Swift Boat ads, you know, which certainly did hurt him in the polls. But the thing people forget is he actually came back and polled even or ahead of Bush with his performance in the debates.
Yep.
And then he lost it again.
Yep.
Which, again, to me underscores kind of the old cliche of a week or however long is a lifetime in politics, that, you know, Bill Clinton was in third place in 92 in April with the Democrats convention. He pulled ahead.
Yeah, though that was really unusual for a lot of reasons, not least of which was the incredibly strange performance of Ross Perot, which had a huge impact of him dropping out and getting back in. That was an unusual earthquake that sort of released tens of millions of voters.
Yeah, but Clinton actually pulled ahead of Perot even before Perot dropped out. I mean, that was kind of what part of the reason Perot did drop out in the first place, is he began to see, one, his chances diminishing, and two, the need for him to be in there to wound Bush, who he really
right.
disliked, as having diminished. So, you know, I think the conventions tend to be the sort of equalizing force. You tend to get a bounce on both sides. You
yeah.
start around Labor Day. And I suspect if you look at the Electoral College math and the battleground states, around Labor Day it's going to be pretty close to even, and they're going to whoever the nominees are going to have to win it on their own terms. And I don't think people are going to be looking back to stuff that was going on in March or April as having been determinative.
That was the case in 1996. And you had a real unusual opportunity where, because you usually have candidates on even ground. In 1996, you had, Clinton with tens of millions of dollars that he could spend finding Dole.
But he was an incumbent, too. I mean, I think that's a different, different set of parameters.
It's true, but nonetheless, you had this financial disparity that almost all observers consider to be really important. And you would have had that potential in the spring, and that potential is going to be gone.
Yeah. Well, look, if this really hurts Obama's fundraising, that's a different argument.
Oh, it's not. It's helping it, but he's spending it all against Clinton.
If it's hurting his purse, if it's significantly hurting his purse, then I think that's an argument I'd entertain. If it's the matter of hurting his image or you know, what I was responding to in my piece was the notion that there's something kind of unusually mean-spirited, nasty, ruthless, Nixonian about Clinton's strategy and the nature of her negative campaigning. And in my article, I said I think that is a perception that is just deeply influenced by either animosity toward her or just a desire to see Obama win and a sympathy or preference for him that is sort of distorting the severity of these attacks. And, you know, if we want to kind of segue into some of those questions, I mean, you know, to me, stuff that would be beyond the pale, you know, that would warrant Nixonian, is you break into the opponent's headquarters, you do what Bush did in 2000 in Florida, you organize a mob to shut down a recount of votes.
Yeah.
You know, you try to impeach somebody for kind of nakedly partisan reasons. I mean, these to me are political actions that go, you know, that cross a line, that are beyond the pale, that legitimately summon some kind of, you know, not just defense of the candidate or person we prefer, but actually some real moral outrage. And I see so much...
I agree that nothing Clinton has done is as bad as Nixon's worst crimes.
Right, okay. And I
point
just
totally
see,
conceded.
Okay, I appreciate that. I see so much commentary on a daily basis in the blogs and, you know, even in kind of mainstream outlets that suggest that there is something, you know, singularly scorched earth or ruthless, that, you know, I think when... you know, I guess it was Bill Clinton's phrase, was chill out. And I sort of resent a little bit the fact that the Clinton campaign has now come around to this point that I was arguing because, you know, it diminishes the kind of independence, the appearance of independence of my argument. but nonetheless, I think I made it first. That there is a need to kind of put some of this stuff in perspective. And in fact, I would suggest that somebody who can really go to the mat and fight hard is somebody that liberals should be proud of. And I mentioned in my article, it was only a couple of years ago, it seemed, that this was in fact what not only liberals, but also the left and the whole kind of left of center spectrum was demanding.
Right.
You know, someone who would stand up, fight hard, fight back, who would not simply be kind of a pushover and get bogged down. Oh, is this a nice thing to do? And is this really fair? And you know, that of course we want all our politicians to have a basic sense of integrity, but that we don't want them to be unduly hampered by procedural niceties to the point where it's a kind of unilateral disarmament. And so I would submit that, you know, these qualities that Clinton has been demonstrating actually should be seen in her favor rather than her disfavor.
Right. Well, you know, I think the flaw in your argument is that you're misreading or oversimplifying what people wanted. What people wanted was a more partisan Democratic Party. They basically said we had one very, very partisan party in the Republicans and one party that didn't act in a coherent, strategic, partisan way. But they wanted the Democrats to do that. That means partisanship means two things. It means, you know, getting tougher with the opposition and being more unified. But it also means acting in your party's interest and not doing things that are going to subvert your own party, you know, in its fight against the Republican with Republicans. So what Clinton's doing is exactly in that vein. It's sort of the same reason that people were angry with Joe Lieberman. He was tough, but you know he was tough against his own side. That's you know, not what people wanted.
But Clinton actually is much more, again, the party of the candidate. And Obama has been much more either the party of the movement that tends to be critical of the Democratic Party from the left, or with this kind of trans-partisan, post-partisan, non-partisan, anti-partisan appeal, has been the one to kind of avoid partisanship or at least rhetorically take the posture of eschewing partisanship. And I remember a number of people seized on when Sid Blumenthal had that quote in The New Yorker about Clinton's candidacy being the fulfillment of partisanship.
Right.
that was seen as, you know, a negative. But I would say that actually does capture an important difference between the candidates. That if you believe that the Democratic Party, you know, has been and sort of remains the best instrument for delivering liberal change, then she tends to be the candidate you prefer. And if you believe that, no, it's got to come from this kind of reform and a new politics and something that's, you know, outside our current two-party system, then you probably tend to favor Obama, at least if, you know, if you're in that realm of people voting in the Democratic primary.
You know, I certainly agree with you that there's a pretty strong tension between Obama and the Netroots. He's, you know, said nasty things about Daily Kos and some of the blogs, and some of those blogs really didn't like him, especially at the beginning, although as they've seen that he's going to be the guy, they've come to his side because they're partisans. But and in fact, Hillary Clinton's worldview was much closer to theirs. But that's one of the things I like about Obama, which is that, you know, he doesn't have this absolute scorched earth view of how to proceed in American politics. And in fact, that's one of the things I think that makes people like Blumenthal and you know, I think there's probably, you know, some other liberals who are strongly pro-Clinton, you know, like Sean Wilentz and Paul Krugman, or people who I admire a lot of their work. But I feel like the Obama message is essentially, his message to independents and Republicans is essentially this. He says, let's not argue about, you know, who was wrong or who was right in the past. You know, let's not argue about whether, you know, who voted for which president, who started which disastrous war, and whose policies didn't work, even though, you know, he knows perfectly well what the answer is, and
right.
Probably
well,
they do too.
And but he is arguing a lot about who started the war.
Right, but it's not, you know, it's just a way of saying, like, let's forget about all that, let's just move past it, and basically embrace a set of policies that aren't very different from what Hillary Clinton would do.
Right.
And I think to a certain subset of liberals, this is, I mean, there's a dishonesty to it. Or at least it's a lack of honesty. It's you know, what they want is to shove it in their face and say, you were wrong, we were right, now we're going to beat you and we're going to do what we wanted to do all along. Instead of saying, let's all forget about the past and who was wrong and who was right, and let's all sort of move forward. And I think, you know, to some of these Clinton supporters, it's almost like you're dishonoring the victims of Republican partisanship to do this. It's like, you know,
I think that's right.
You know,
that's a very good.
You know, and that's what I think galls them. They want to win, and then they want to have like a truth commission to the criminals of the impeachment saga and all the misdeeds of the Bush administration have to be identified and punished, which is an impulse I understand and relate to. I just don't think that's necessarily the best way to create the practical results you're after.
Well, I think that is a good point. And I certainly give Obama immense credit for the way he has kind of tacked between these, I think, very different sort of rhetorical or campaign approaches, where he actually, I think, has been quite capable of, you know, campaigning very negatively. You know, I wrote in my piece that if you look back in October, late October, where Clinton was significantly ahead in the polls, Obama actually comes out and says, you know, my supporters and any other columnists kind of urging him to go negative, and he kind of comes out and says, I'm going to do this, I'm going to start confronting her, and using these, you know, nice words for going negative, confrontational or aggressive or drawing distinctions.
Contrast,
right. And they do it in the debate, in that October debate where Clinton really did a poor job, and Obama and Edwards both were kind of, you know, going much more negative. And then you saw that take its toll, I think, over the next month. And yet then when Clinton said, now the fun begins, or something to that effect, and saying she was going to start going negative and back, you know, this whole chorus kind of jumping on her, saying, oh, she's taking pleasure in the going negative. And I, you know, it seems to me that it's rewarding. The problem is not whether you're going negative or not, or how negative or how mean, but rather that Obama is very good at affecting this posture of being the reluctant warrior, you know, more in sorrow than in anger, and not getting his fingerprints on some of the stuff. I mean, it's interesting, you know, you'll see Leahy and Dodd go out and say she's got to get out, and then Obama himself can take the high ground and say, oh, I think she should stay in it as long as she wants, which I give him credit for saying, but, you know, it just struck me as this is a very clever and, you know, arguably successful. I mean, it could be, you say this is a point in his favor that he's if not perfected, you know, mastered a kind of political style that works this way.
Right, no, you're right. I mean, I disagree with you that he's been, if you're trying to say that he's been as negative as she is.
I don't know about right. I think there's been plenty to go around that the question.
There is. He, no, he's not. He's not all sweetness and light, and she's not all. He's not dark. I think she's been nastier than he has, and I think there's a real ham-handedness to some of her attacks. But again,
sure,
like, But you're right. I mean, all politicians have to say why you should vote for me and not for the other person. I mean, those both elements are present in anyone. No one just runs saying, here's what's great about me, and ends it at that. No one. You have to prove your... But I think you're right that, you know, he does it in a way that I think is less ham-handed. And to me, he's less intellectually offensive. I didn't say morally offensive, but I think, you know, some of her attacks are intellectually offensive, like seizing on his comment about how Reagan was a transformative president who changed the country in a lot of ways to try to make it sound like he was praising Ronald Reagan's policies and saying he was
president than Reagan. Just to correct the record, the one that she really emphasized was where he said for the last 10 to 15 years, which is, you know, start of Bill Clinton's presidency,
right,
that the Republicans have been the party of ideas.
And which he defined as saying in the sense that they were trying to change the conventional wisdom, and that's true. I think. My book was about, and a lot of people have agreed that basically, like, even when Democrats have had power, like they did in the Clinton years, they've been fighting on Republican turf on terms of debate set by the right. That was Obama's point.
No, but
and of course the Clintons were offended by it.
But I think that's exactly wrong. I think it was during the Reagan years that you could say that the Republicans kind of had. You know, we're challenging the conventional wisdom and putting forward, you know, ideas that hadn't been in as wide circulation in political life. But it was precisely with Clinton that you saw a new liberalism emerge, you know, with his kind of hybrid, you know, third way or whatever you want to call it. And you can argue about the merits of those ideas, but the notion that, you know, there was this dearth of new ideas and that Democrats in the 90s were kind of still operating on 60s liberalism or New Deal liberalism, I think is just historically wrong and, you know, a slap at Clinton, you know, as well. And in fact, I think you've written this, I might be wrong, but certainly others have written it, that much of the rhetoric of all the Democratic candidates this year owes a tremendous amount to Clintonism and to the way that Clinton's time in office fashioned a new synthesis of liberalism that, you know, made fiscal responsibility more a part of things, that kind of took away the Democrats' weakness on issues of crime, began to even do so on issues of national security and kind of fashioning a new robust liberal internationalism in, I think, the second half of Clinton's term. So, we're getting into a digression.
Right, even if you're right, I want to get into this digression because it's interesting, but even if you're right, first of all, okay, so what Obama's saying is that Democrats were arguing on a Republican terrain and Republicans still controlled the terms of debate, which you disagree with, but it's not the same as saying that he agreed with and approved of their ideas, which is what Clinton said he said. It's a totally different point. You disagree with his point anyway, but it's still not the point that she said he made.
Well,
number two, I actually think it's an interesting thing to get into, because I remember I wrote a piece for the New Republic in 1998, in spring of 1998, saying basically that Clinton has finally gotten off the ideological ropes and has actually started to fashion, you know, an agenda that's not just school uniforms and tiny stuff, but is really, you know, pushing in a significant way to, you know, to enact some of the goals that he wanted to do all along.
Right.
That came out the day before the Monica Lewinsky scandal broke, so none of it ever came to it. But I remember when I was reporting this piece, I talked to Sid Blumenthal, so that, hey, you know, he'll really, you know, he'll provide me with some of the detail here to back up this thesis, for which I've already accumulated some evidence. But actually, the conversation was useless because he refused to accede to the premise that there was any point during the Clinton administration which they weren't already in this, you know, glorious era of liberal progress. that, you know, he wouldn't concede that there had been any delta here whatsoever. And that's the thing, you know, for the pure Clinton loyalists, that's their real belief. And I'm not putting you in that category, but that's the thing that I think really angered them about Obama's comments, this idea that they were, you know, on the ropes in some ways, that they were arguing on Republican terrain in the 1990s. Like, no, it was always wonderful. It was always, you know, it was glorious in every respect. So, you know, I think there is an argument about the role of the Clinton administration, and there is a deeply felt dispute here about to what extent the Clinton presidency was successful. But as far as the Reagan example and the party of ideas, I think that was just in my mind, just a pure distortion.
Okay, but let's table for, you know, our kind of historical corner. I know they on Blogging right. Heads they have like a Science Saturday or something. They should have a Historian's, you know, Monday.
I'm sure that would just be immensely popular. I don't know why they haven't thought of this yet.
Anyway, but the point I wanted to get back to was this notion of kind of intellectually insulting. If I may disclose, at one point you said you kind of think some of this stuff insults your intelligence. But it seems to me if you have Merrill McPeak up there, you know, clearly taking out of context a comment of Bill Clinton's and saying this is McCarthyism, you know, the stuff with Geraldine Ferraro, it seems to me there's plenty of examples on the other side, too, where there is a kind of, you know, deliberate taking out of context of comments and then ginning up a kind of outrage among one's own supporters and one hopes also among the media to sort of win a news cycle or two. And
well,
put
with Ferraro, the more context, the worse she looked. The more she talked, then she would start saying, "Well, I'm being attacked because I'm white."
But the controversy was already in full bloom when she made that remark, and that her initial remarks, which were, you know, plucked from, you know, a seventh paragraph of an obscure paper, you know, we're not so controversial, and it's just, my point is here,
they were pretty controversial.
Pseudo-controversies that are manufactured by both sides, and that, in a way, and even in talking about this now, we are falling victim to this, the media have just sort of happily swum along with this tide, instead of sort of, you know, saying, you know what, this stuff is not really worth our reporting on. Let's go actually do a little more investigative legwork and find out something substantial about, you know, what Clinton did as First Lady, or what Obama did as state senator, you know, of which there's been precious little reporting, which I think are kind of the most important things, is the candidate's past record of achievement.
I think there's been a lot about that.
Oh, I think there's been very little. I mean, you know, there was this Pew report that came out, or maybe it was Project for Excellence in Journalism, that said, you know, it was 1% of the reporting. I mean, this was a while ago, but even so, 1% was an actual, you know, their record of achievement.
Right.
Now, there's, you know, whatever, when it becomes a issue of controversy, like, you know, the sniper fire stuff, then they'll go back and say, oh, what actually happened? But why hasn't anybody done, you know, a month or two ago, a long takeout piece on, you know, what exactly was Clinton's role in promoting women's rights in the administration or in, you know, some of these international crises, you know? But
I think there have been a lot of pieces that there's so much horse race reporting that it's going to drown out the 1% or whatever it is. But, I mean, all those pieces have been done. What they don't get done is, like, they don't get redone and recycled. But basically, I think every aspect of their lives and careers has been combed over and reported. And, you know, all the papers run those pieces.
Well, maybe you are more voracious consumer, you know,
I'm pretty voracious.
You know,
because it's my day job, but it's not your day job.
That's true, and you know, I'm stuck with just, you know, the New York Times and the Washington Post, and you know, the handful of
the Times
blogs and websites I get to each day. There's been some, but I think journalists should be focused much more on the matter of the candidate's relative credentials and past experience. I mean, I should fix that. Not experience per se, but actual record of achievement, which I think, you know, one friend of mine says experience is sort of like a synonym for age, that
right.
Just sit there long enough. So I think the Clinton campaign was in a way mistaken in latching onto that word. But I think, you know, there are questions of, you know, whether Obama is a man of significant accomplishment.
Right. And, there are questions about Clinton as well.
Yeah, right. I think less so, but you know, to the degree that people have those questions, they should be answered. And, you know, I just don't see a lot of that. And what I see is that both campaigns have been actually very eager to sort of sacrifice kind of a larger case in the interest of these short-term gains through the news cycles by playing to these pseudo-controversies. And, you know, to me, that's kind of this mutual short-sightedness on both candidates' part.
Yeah, I just think you're wrong about the investigative stuff. I mean, every aspect of Obama's legislative career has been combed over in these long outtake investigative pieces that have been, you know, weeks and weeks of reporting, as well as all the Resco stuff and every other scandal or potential scandal they could look at. And the same is true of Clinton. I've read, you know, lots of long pieces about her record at First Lady and before as well.
Well, I don't know. I mean, we maybe I'm not expecting you here and now to quote chapter and verse, but if you can sort of suggest some of these, you know, I for one would be interested in reading some of them.
Yeah, well, I don't know how much our viewers want to hear this debate. But
right. Okay. Well, we can email me them offline.
I'll email
but
you.
I just as a serious point. I mean, I actually would like to see more of this, and if I've missed it, you know, which I, you know, happily admit is a possibility, then, you know, then I'd like to read it, and it may affect my perception of these two candidates and my sense of how ready or fit either one of them is for the presidency.
Right. But we're making a sub-point of a sub-point. And I actually think the point you were making that, you know, what I was trying to say is even if you think that he's been just as tough as she is, which is a point I dispute, but we can table that.
Right.
The point I'm trying to say is, and this is what you were saying before, like, his ability to do it while people think he's being nice is quite an important political asset. I mean, clearly the perception is that she's being nastier, right? I mean, like, polls show, like, has one candidate attacked the other unfairly? Many more Democrats think she's attacked him unfairly than
Yeah, and that's partly what I was trying to argue against, yeah.
Right, and now, I mean, again, I probably think that's true, but even if it's not true, he should be the guy you want. The whole key to being a successful attacker is to make people think you're not being an attacker.
Well, yeah, I mean, sure. I think there is that political virtue in it, but it also, to me, underscores part of his political style that I just find troubling because it goes to a tradition within liberalism that you know, often goes too far in you know, putting means before ends. And obviously, you know, none of us are here people who think, you know, the ends always justify the means. But, you know, I think if you read The Audacity of Hope, which is sort of, I think reading that book first kind of helped me congeal my thinking on some of this stuff, there is, I think, quite little audacity in that book. There's a lot of back and forth on the one hand, on the other hand. And he describes at one point, I wrote about this in Dissent back in the fall. I did, Lord knows why I agreed to do this, to read all the candidates' campaign books and sort of to compare and write about them. And it was called Reading the Candidates.
That's when you missed all the long pieces in the paper.
Right, exactly. They were done back in the summer when I was writing this piece. But, you know, when Obama describes his star turn at the 2004 convention, it's sort of in these weary tones, sort of saying, oh, you know, sure, it was nice that everybody sort of gave me this attention, but then I had to dutifully mouth these talking points of the Kerry Edwards campaign. And the whole thing sounds kind of weary. And I compared it to Bill Richardson, who's clearly reveling in the politics, loving it.
Yeah.
He smuggles in these jars of salsa with his own face on it as, you know, kind of a way of doing self-promotion. And you kind of compare the two styles. And I think, you know, history to me suggests that politicians, and especially liberal politicians, succeed better when they show and especially when they have a real love of politics and don't feel this kind of, you know, ambivalence that seems to me to be kind of part of Obama's style and perhaps of his person too.
Well, but isn't there also the? I mean, you're the historian, and I'm not, so we're definitely. I'm definitely going into.
Well, you're a full-time journalist, and I'm not, so you've been able to read all these pieces that I have.
That's true. I guess it's only fair that we have a debate on terrain that you're qualified to discuss, and I'm not.
But let's talk. Can we talk about Andrew Jackson for a minute?
No, but I mean, isn't the notion of the reluctant warrior a hallowed myth that the Americans look to time and time again? Someone who, you know, a Dwight Eisenhower, someone who's called into something that isn't his natural, something that he, like, his politics is something that people think of as being compromising and dirty, and finding someone who doesn't love the muck, isn't that attractive to people?
Well, sure. I mean, there definitely is that attractive aspect of it. But there's also sort of the great tradition of the happy warrior of you know, Al Smith or FDR.
No, they're both traditions. That's
right.
My point. They're both traditions, and just to say that because someone's in one tradition doesn't mean that they can't succeed.
Oh, I don't think it means he can't succeed. But to me, there is a tradition particularly that has infected post-World War II liberalism that has been hobbled by its squeamishness about the political side of politics, about fighting, about sort of the hard stuff that I think, you know, if you look at the great Democratic presidents since FDR, Truman, you know, Kennedy, Johnson, and Clinton, you know, they have all really evinced that.
Saying he's fought just as hard as she has, right? That's your whole point, so I don't understand what the problem is.
Well, my problem is that he
just says he's a nice guy.
There's this kind of troubling ambivalence about his posture to me. It's not that I don't think he's capable of achieving things, but I just don't see the grounds in his record for affirmatively believing that.
Well, that's a different point, though. I mean, your point previously, you were saying that he's in this Adlai Stevenson tradition of being too reluctant to fight, but you're also saying he actually is a fighter and he's just as tough as she is. So,
well, yeah. I mean, I guess I wouldn't put it quite that starkly. I think he has shown that he is capable of engaging in some fighting, and I think that's to his credit. Whether his overall posture when it comes to being president will be one of someone who's really going to get the job done, I'm still unconvinced. So I would position it somewhere in the middle. I wouldn't say he is Adlai Stevenson. And when I talk about these things, I mean, a lot of folks don't always understand sort of the way that history plays into political debate. It's not to make analogies. It's not to say, oh, Adlai Stevenson lost, so therefore Obama will lose. It's to identify traditions and to identify, you know, whether these are kind of healthy traditions or what aspects of them are sound and what need to be retained and what need to be modified and so on. And so clearly there's a lot about that Adlai Stevenson legacy that is, you know, essential to liberalism. But there is also, I think, this ambivalence that I do see in Obama that I think is worrisome.
But it hasn't manifested itself in any reluctance to fight, is what you're also saying.
Well, I suppose not. I suppose not. And whether that would also be the case as president, you know, I don't know.
Okay, well, I suppose we'll never know. Maybe he'll be willing to fight for his politics and his policies as a primary campaigner, but not as president. It seems unlikely, but you know, we couldn't know for sure. But we've hit an hour, so
right,
we should probably wrap
up. I was noticing that too. So anyway, it's a good note to end on.
Okay.
All right.
Thanks a lot for the talk, David. I enjoyed it.
You too, John.
Okay.
Bye.